Hello, this is Guy Kawasaki. The title of this talk is The Art of Raising Capital. It is based on the seventh chapter of my book, The Art of the Start. This talk explains the process of raising capital from outside investors. These investors may be venture capitalists, foundations, government entities, your management, or the three F's, friends, fools, and family. My experience is with Silicon Valley venture capitalists. You may never try to get an investment from these folks. However, if you can raise capital from Silicon Valley venture capitalists, you can probably raise capital from anyone. As the Frank Sinatra song goes, if I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. Skillful pitching, which we covered in another MP3 recording, is a necessary but not sufficient part of raising capital. What's more important is the realities of your organization. Are you building something meaningful, long-lasting, and valuable to society? Now, let me provide the main points of the art of raising capital. First, build a business. If you want to get an investment, show that you'll build a business. Make meaning. Make a difference. Don't do it for the money. Do it because you want to make the world a better place. This applies to the geekiest of technology startups, as well as low-tech, no-tech, and not-for-profit organizations. If you build a business, either investors will be fighting to give you money, or you won't need their money. Either is a good problem to have. On the other hand, if you perform unnatural acts to raise money, you probably won't build a business, and you probably won't get the money anyway. A logical and fair question is, how do I build a business without capital? The bottom line is, you find a way. That's what entrepreneurs do. As venture capitalist Hunt Green said, everything is always impossible before it works. That is what entrepreneurs are all about, doing what other people have told them is impossible. Second, get an intro. In publishing, movies, music, and venture capital, there's a fairy tale scenario that goes like this. You submit a draft, script, song, or business plan to an organization. Despite the mounds of other submissions, the quality of your pitch is so stellar that someone frantically asks you to come in for a meeting. After one meeting, you cut a deal, and soon the money is wired into your account. Dream on. God is my witness, this is a true story. A startup had given up on getting money from a top-tier venture capitalist because they heard that there was no interest. I asked the partner at the firm why it had passed, and he told me it was because his associate knew a company in Europe that was doing the same thing. Also, the company had supposedly achieved 100% market share in Europe and was coming to the U.S. already. Therefore, it was probably already too late for another entrant. I asked the associate who the company was. He didn't know. A friend had told him about it. I contacted this friend, and he also didn't know who the company was. Apparently, another friend had told him about the company and how it had 98% market share in a tiny vertical market in Eastern Europe. Let's review this situation. A friend told a friend who told an associate who told a partner not to bother looking at the company. This tale illustrates why you need an introduction by a credible party to get to the decision makers. The point is not that the submission process should be or is a level playing field. The point is to tilt the playing field in your direction by getting an introduction by sources that investors respect. Here are some of them. Current investors. One of the most valuable services a current investor can provide is to help find additional investors. This is part of the game, so don't hesitate to ask for help. Most investors will at least listen to the recommendations of other investors. When you pick a lawyer, accountant, or PR firm, look for connections as well as competence. Ask them if they will introduce you to sources of capital. Lots of firms can do good work, so find one that can do both good work and make introductions. Other entrepreneurs. A call or email from an entrepreneur to his investor saying, "This is a hot company. You should talk to them." It's very powerful. Go to the investor's website to figure out which companies he's invested in. Perhaps he'll know someone at one of these companies. If not, get to know someone at one of those companies. Execs at these companies are probably easier to get to than the investor himself. For those who are starting not-for-profits, look at the organizations that the foundation has already funded. Professors. Investors are impressed by the suggestions of professors. In Silicon Valley, for example, a call or email from an engineering professor from Stanford will get the attention of any venture capitalist. What if you don't know these kinds of folks? Well, it's a cruel world. Raising capital isn't an equal opportunity activity, so get out there and get connected. Third, show traction. Generally, investors are looking for a proven team with proven technology and proven sales. Investors rank these factors in different order, but the factor that cuts through all the hyperbole is racking up sales. In Silicon Valley, we call this traction, in the sense that a tire grips the road and moves a vehicle forward. Traction counts the most because you've proven that people are willing to open their wallets, take out money, and put it in your pocket. That's the bottom line of a company. If you can do this, the provenness of your team and technology is less important. Traction takes on different meanings in different industries. It's straightforward to define that for companies, revenues. In other cases, revenues may not be the parameter. For schools, it's enrollment and test scores. For churches, it's attendance at services. For museums, it's number of visitors. For volunteer organizations, it's the level of contribution and number of volunteer hours. This raises a logical question. What if my product or service isn't finished yet? How can I show traction? Well, there is a complex answer to this question. There is what I call the hierarchy of traction, with all due respect to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. This is the pecking order of the hierarchy of traction. First, on the top, is sales. No discussion. Second is field testing, pilot sites, and beta customers. At least someone is using and trying your technology. Third is an agreement to do one of these field tests or pilot projects. Fourth and last is that at least you have a contact to pursue a field test. The higher you are in this hierarchy, the better. But if you don't have at least a contact for a field test, you'll have a very hard time raising money. Fourth, clean up your act. Other than in times of irrational exuberance, most investors are looking for reasons not to do a deal. Statistically, they would be right because most deals don't pan out. Think of an investor's deal flow as a funnel. About 2,000 business plans enter at the top of the funnel every year. 200 are moderately credible. 100 are interesting enough to read. 40 undergo due diligence. 10 get funded. And maybe one or two makes a bundle of money. Investors want to weed out rejects as fast as possible because they don't want to waste time. And obvious flaws make it easy to throw out a plan. So you have to present a clean slate. Here are the areas where flaws abound. Intellectual property. Maybe it's a lawsuit or the risk of a lawsuit by former employers claiming that your technology belongs to them. Or that core technology belongs to the founder, not the company itself. Or perhaps there's infringement on someone else's patents. Capital structure. Ownership of the vast majority of the organization by a few founders who are not willing to spread out the ownership is a problem. Dominant control by an inflexible investor who doesn't want any dilution is a problem. Management team. Suppose the management team is married to each other or related. That's a problem. Unqualified friends or roommates in CXO level positions. That's a problem. The lack of relevant industry experience is also a problem. Stock offerings. Grants of stock, as opposed to options, to consultants and vendors in lieu of payment. Common stock sold to friends and family at high valuations. Solicitation of investors who are not qualified according to securities laws. Finally, there's regulatory compliance. Non-compliance with state or federal laws and regulations, non-payment of payroll taxes, all of these are big problems. Fifth, disclose everything. If there's crud that hasn't been or cannot be cleaned up immediately, then disclose it to the investors. Do it early in the process. The later you do it, the harder it'll get, and the more it'll harm your credibility. Garage once invested in a company that disclosed that one potential investor had a consulting agreement with the company. This deal came to light shortly before the financing was closing. The investor was both buying stock as well as receiving stock and cash for consulting services. No other investor had a similar deal. When the other investors found out about this, the deal almost collapsed. Had the company disclosed this arrangement to the other investors and explained why it made sense for everyone, which it did, things would have gone a lot more smoothly. Unfortunately, the company lost a high-value investor because of this last-minute issue. What if you started or worked for an organization that failed? There's no use in trying to hide this fact because investors will uncover it. It's also poor form to blame anyone or anything else, the market, other employees, customers, or in particular the investors, for what happened. My recommendation is that you do a mea culpa, that is, accept as much blame for the failure as possible and confess your sins. Sophisticated investors find this admirable, and many an investor has made boatloads of money betting on entrepreneurs who failed in earlier efforts. What's important is not that you failed, it's that you learn from your failures, and that you're willing and able to try again. The lesson is, clean up your problems or disclose your problems, but never hide your problems. Sixth, acknowledge, or create an enemy. Many entrepreneurs believe that investors want to hear that the organization has no competition. Unfortunately, sophisticated investors reach one or both of the following conclusions if they hear this. First, there's no competition because there's no market. If there were a market, there would be others trying to win it. Second, the founders are so clueless they can't even use Google to figure out that 10 companies are doing the same thing. Starting an organization to serve a market that doesn't exist or exhibiting cluelessness is not conducive to raising money. A moderate level of competition is a good thing because it validates the market. Furthermore, the fact that you are aware of your competition shows that you've done your homework. It's your job to show how superior you are to the competition, not that it doesn't exist. You can use a chart to explain what you and your competition can and cannot do to accomplish this. Make this chart with three columns, company name in the first column. Second column is, we can do, they can't. Third column is, we can't do, they can. You should list all the things that you can't do and the competition can, because this builds credibility. You may find this surprising, but you should list the things that you can't do and the competition can, because this builds credibility. You are realistically appraising the competition, you are communicating your knowledge clearly and succinctly, and you are willing to present facts that don't always make you look good. You can also use this chart to promote the relevance of your product or service to the marketplace by mapping your capabilities to the needs of your customers. That is, the list of what we can do capabilities should immediately illustrate that there's a need for your product or service. So be bold. Openly discuss your strengths and weaknesses. It'll make your strengths more believable. Unfortunately, no one ever does it this way. Instead, they contrive a matrix that makes them look good, frequently with irrelevant, if not downright silly, parameters. Parameters like right-handed CEOs, or drives hybrid cars, or vegan employees, using open source code. If you truly don't have any competition, then zoom out until you do. Competition can be the reliance on the status quo. Microsoft, since at some point Microsoft will compete with everyone for everything, or researchers in universities. Pick something. Pick something, because saying you have no competition at all is a non-starter. Seventh, tell new lies. In a typical day, an investor meets with two or three companies and sees another four or five executive summaries. Each company claims to represent a unique and earth-shattering opportunity with a proven team, proven technology, and proven market. No company claims to be a bunch of losers who don't know what they're doing. Also, you might think that you and your meeting are the center of the universe. In fact, you're just a 10 o'clock meeting. There was one at 8, there was one at 9, there'll be one at 11, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Part of the center of the universe delusion is that entrepreneurs think they're telling investors something new. For the sake of investors like me who are tired of hearing the same old lies, and for the sake of entrepreneurs who hurt their case by telling them, here are the top 10 lies that entrepreneurs tell investors. At least you should tell new lies. Lie number one, our projection is conservative. Not only is your projection conservative, but you'll be doing $100 million by year 4. In fact, the company is going to be growing faster than any company in the history of mankind. Your projection isn't conservative. Frankly, you have no clue what your sales will be. I fantasize about the day that an entrepreneur tells me, frankly, our projection is picked out of the air. We're trying to make them high enough to interest you, but low enough so that we don't look like idiots. We really have no clue until we ship the product and see how it's accepted. At least that entrepreneur is honest. Lie number two. Gartner or Forrester or Jupiter or Yankee Group says our market will be $50 billion in 5 years. Don't cite these kinds of numbers and expect to impress investors. No one comes in and says we're in a crappy little market. Everyone says they're in a big and growing market. Lie number three. Boeing or some other big name company is signing our contract next week. As I said, traction is good. It really makes you fundable. But until a contract is signed, it's not signed. When the investor checks in a week and the contract isn't signed, you've got a real problem. In 5 years, I've never seen a contract signed on time. Talk about Boeing and your big deal after they're done. In general, make sure that all surprises to investors are upside surprises. Line number four. Key employees will join us as soon as we get funded. Now let me get this straight. You're two guys in a garage. You're trying to raise a few $100,000. Your product is 12 months from completion, and you're telling me that these well-known people, that very well-known companies are going to resign their $250,000 per year jobs, plus they have stock options, and they're going to join your company. When we've checked with these key employees about how they're all set to join the company, the response, more often than not, is, I vaguely remember meeting her at a cocktail party. If you're going to tell this lie, make sure the potential employees are locked and loaded and ready to quit. Lie number 5. Several investors are already in due diligence. If you don't hurry, someone else will invest in us and you won't have the chance. This works well in times of irrational exuberance, but it is generally laughable. The reality and what the listener is thinking is, you've pitched a few other investors and they haven't gotten around to rejecting you yet. The odds are the investors know each other better than you know them. They can easily call up their buddies and find out how interested another firm is in your deal. To pull this lie off, you'd better be either a great bluffer or smoking hot, or you won't get a chance against investors who know each other. Lie number 6. Procter & Gamble or some other big company is too old, big, dumb, slow, etc., etc., to be a threat. Well, let me tell you something. Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, Oracle, Ford, all those big companies, they're not stupid, they're not big, and they're not slow. Many entrepreneurs think that by making such a statement, they are convincing the investors of their moxie, proving that they can defeat an entrenched competitor, and establishing a competitive advantage. In reality, they are only showing how naive they are about what it takes to build a successful business. There's a reason why people like Larry Ellison can keep the San Jose airport open late for their private jets, while you and I are munching peanuts on Southwest Airlines. And it's not because they are old, big, dumb, and slow. It's scary enough to investors that you are competing with an established company. Don't seal your coffin by showing how clueless you are by denigrating such competition. Instead, build the case for these kinds of alternatives. Partnering with the competition. Flying under its radar. Addressing a niche that it can't or won't address. These will work. Lie number 7. Patents make our business defensible. Patents do not make a business defensible. They might provide a competitive advantage, particularly in material science, medical devices, and biotech companies, but that's about it. Garage, for example, has a patent on the process of investors and entrepreneurs using the internet to catalyze investments. Do I sleep better at night because of this? Has it prevented investment banks, laid off investment bankers and consultants from using the internet to connect buyers and sellers of private placement? Would we try to enforce the patent? The answers are respectively no, no, and no. By all means, file for patents if you can, but don't depend on them for much more than impressing your parents unless you have the time, years, and money, millions, to go to court. If Apple's son in the Department of Justice can't beat Microsoft in court, you can't either. When talking to investors, the optimal number of times to mention that your technology is patentable is 1. 0 is bad because it implies you don't have anything proprietary. More than 1 means that you're clueless and think patents make your business defensible. Lie number 8. All we have to do is get 1% of the market. This is what venture capitalists call the Chinese soda lie. That is, if just 1% of the people in China drank our soda, they will be more successful than any company in the history of mankind. There are 4 problems with this line of reasoning. First, it's not that easy to get 1% of the people in China to drink your soda. Second, very few entrepreneurs are truly going after a market as large as the people in China. Third, the company that came in before you said the same thing about another market. Fourth, the company is shooting for only 1% of a market. That's just not that interesting. The right thing to do is to either come up with a believable total adjustable market figure or catalyze fantasy so the investor can come up with a number himself. But saying that all you have to do is get 1% of a big market labels you as a bozo. Lie number 9. We have first mover advantage. There are 2 problems with this lie. First, you may not have the first mover advantage. How can you possibly know that no one else is doing what you're doing? As a rule of thumb, if you're doing something good, 5 other companies are doing the same thing. If you're doing something great, 10 are. Second, first mover advantage isn't all that it's cracked up to be. Sometimes being a fast second may be better. Let someone else make the mistakes, learn from their mistakes, and then leapfrog them. Lie number 10. We have a world-class proven team. The definition of world-class and proven in this context is that the founders created enormous wealth for investors in a previous company, or they held positions in a highly respected, publicly traded company. Riding the tornado of a successful company in a minor role, working for McKinsey as a consultant, or putting in a couple years at Morgan Stanley isn't a proven background. Those are the top 10 lies of entrepreneurs. As I said, at least tell different lies. Eighth, don't fall for the trick questions. In addition to telling new lies, you'll also need to correctly answer trick questions. Investors pose these questions to see if you're inexperienced or dumb enough to utter the wrong answers. These are some good guidelines. First, I'll tell you the investor trick question, then I'll tell you what you want to say, and then I'll tell you what you should say. Question: what makes you think you're qualified to run this organization? What you want to say: what makes you think you're qualified to run this venture capital firm? What you should say: I've done okay so far getting to this point, but if it ever becomes necessary, I'll gladly step aside. Question: do you see yourself as a long-term CEO of this organization? What you'd like to ask: what do the investors in your fund see in you as a partner investing their money? What you're going to say: I've been focused on getting our stuff to market. I will do whatever is necessary to make this successful, including stepping aside. Here are the logical milestones at which we can make this transition. Question: is ownership control of the organization a big issue for you? What you'd like to say: I'm going to be putting in 80 hours a week to make this successful, and you're asking me if I care how much of it I own? No, it's not. I realize that to make this company successful, we need great employees and great investors. They both need to have a significant stake. I will focus on making the pie bigger, not keeping or getting a bigger part of the pie. Question: what do you see as the liquidity path for this organization? What you'd like to say: an IPO that sets a new record for valuation for NASDAQ. What you should say: we know that we have a lot of work before we can even dream of liquidity. We're designing this company to be a large, successful, and independent entity. Right now, our heads are down and we're working as hard as we can to do this. An IPO would be a dream outcome. Plus, there are these five companies that are possible acquirers in the future. Got this straight? Tell new lies and old truths, not vice versa. Ninth, herd the cats. There may be 50 ways to leave your lover, but there are even more ways for investors to tell you no. Unfortunately, most entrepreneurs can't take no for an answer. Indeed, this is part of being an entrepreneur. Simultaneously, investors don't like to provide a clear and unequivocal rejection. They prefer SHITS, show high interest, then stall. Here are the common responses, using the term loosely, that entrepreneurs receive. You're too early for us. Show us some traction and we'll invest. You're too late for us. I wish you had come to us earlier. If you get a lead investor, we'll be part of the syndicate. We don't have expertise in your sector. We have a conflict of interest with one of our existing companies. I liked your deal, but my partners didn't. You need to prove that your technology can scale. Most of the time, the investor is telling you when hell freezes over. But there are some cases in which investors are genuinely interested but not yet committed. You may get an investment from them, but it will be as hard as herding cats. The key to herding cats is to get one in the bag rather than several close to the finish line, to mix metaphors. It's helpful if this cat is a big, beautiful, and well-known one, but any cat that isn't your relative will do. Winning over an investor is not about providing objective, quantifiable, and compelling information through your pitch, business plan, and references. It's as much a dating process as it is an analytic process. The investor who, quote, might have said no is still watching what you do. Did you try to establish contact after the pitch? Did you answer questions that came up in the pitch? Did you provide the supplemental information that supports your case? Have you surprised the investor by closing big customers or meeting milestones on time or early? Have other high-quality investors written you a check? Persistence along these lines can pay off, and you can provide this sort of update weeks and months after your initial pitch to herd the cats. However, continuing to make contact without demonstrable significant improvements in your story will change your status from persistent to pest, and nobody funds a pest. 10th, understand what you're getting into. Raising money, particularly from venture capitalists, is a difficult and long process, and this is if it all goes well. May the go-go days of the 1990s return, but they may not, and only a bozo would depend on timing the market. To illustrate what kind of people professional investors and venture capitalists are, let me tell you a story. It's not an urban legend about the guy who strapped a rocket engine to his car and plowed into the side of the mountain. I heard the story directly from the venture capitalist. She took her father to dinner at a swanky restaurant with a valet service. On the way there, her father chided her for buying a snazzy BMW. She pulled up in front, got out, and the two of them went into the restaurant. Several hours later, she and her dad came out of the restaurant and saw that her car was still where she parked it. Seizing the day, she told her father, "See, this is why I drive a BMW. They keep the nice cars out front. Now we don't have to wait for it." At that moment, an irritated valet came up to her and said, "Lady, you took your keys with you. We couldn't move your car." What can we learn from this slice of life venture capitalist story? A. Venture capitalists believe that the rules are different for them. B. They believe they are entitled to special treatment. C. You should leave your car running when you pull up to a valet service. D. Venture capitalists aren't necessarily different from you and me. They just happen to manage hundreds of millions of dollars. Or E. All of the above. The correct answer is E. All of the above. Allow me to demythify the aura of venture capitalists. They don't necessarily know any more than you do about your sector. Still, how could you not think this when they are managing hundreds of millions of dollars? Getting a top-tier investor doesn't guarantee that you'll succeed. These firms make many bets, and they assume that most won't pan out. The moment you take a dollar of outside money, you lose control. Control has nothing to do with the math of voting shares. When you take outside money, you are obligated to all shareholders, even if they are in a minority position. Lower your expectations for what they can do for you, and you won't be disappointed. Outside investors can open doors for you to kickstart sales and partnerships. They can help you find other investors. They can prevent you from making mistakes that they've seen in other companies. They can make the world take you slightly more serious because they invested in you. But that's about it. My final point, 11th, find your train ticket. I cannot verify if this is a true story or an urban legend. But a good entrepreneur or writer never lets the truth get in the way of a good lesson. Albert Einstein was on a train. He couldn't find his ticket after searching through all his pockets and bags. The conductor came up to him and said something to the effect of, "Dr. Einstein, everyone knows who you are. We know that Princeton can afford to buy you another train ticket." To which Einstein replied something to the effect of, "I'm not worried about the money. I need to find the ticket to figure out where I'm going." Like Einstein, you too should not worry about the money, but where you are going. If you figure out where you are going, the money will come. Now, I'd like to provide a mini chapter about the art of raising angel capital, a special kind of venture capital. Professional investors and venture capitalists are not the only source of money for startups. There are thousands of wealthy individuals who invest in startups too. Raising money from these folks requires a different approach because their goals are different from professional investors. This doesn't mean that they are easier to get money from, only different. First, don't underestimate them. They may care less about financial returns than professional investors, but that doesn't mean they are suckers. Approach them with the same level of professionalism as if you were pitching a top-tier venture capitalist such as Sequoia Capital or Kleiner Perkins. Second, understand their motivation. Where professional investors want to make money, maybe pay back society, most angels want to pay back society and maybe make money. Angels see two ways to pay back society: helping younger people get a start and helping a product or service get to market that makes meaning. Third, enable these angels to live vicariously. A side benefit that many angels seek is a chance to relive their youth or romantic past. Even though they can't or don't want to start another company, they can enjoy watching you do it. Fourth, make your story comprehensible to a spouse. The investment committee of an angel is his or her spouse. It's not a bunch of geeks, pundits, or former entrepreneurs. This underscores the importance of making your business understandable in short, plain terms. Fifth, be a nice person. Whereas a professional investor might put up with a jerk because a jerk will make them money, angels won't. Angels fall in love with entrepreneurs in a fatherly or motherly way. She's a nice kid. I want to give her a start. So be nice, malleable, and approachable. Come to think of it, this attitude can't hurt when dealing with professional investors too. Sixth, sign up people they know or have heard of. Angel investing is often as much about socializing as profiting. If you can attract one member of the club, you can usually get more to follow. Those are some quick tips about angel investments. We're near the end of this recording, and I wanted to recommend one book for you to learn more about the art of raising capital. It's not a book that is designed to particularly teach you, but it is something that is highly, highly educational in the sense that you can learn how a venture capitalist really thinks and works. The book is by Randall Strauss. It's called E-Boys, the true story of six tall men who backed eBay, Webvan, and other billion-dollar startups. It's from Crown Business. I hope you've enjoyed this recording. For more information about starting a company, please refer to my book, The Art of the Start, and my other MP3 recordings. In particular, you would probably be interested in my MP3 recording called The Art of Pitching. Information about both the book and the MP3 recordings are available at www.artofthestart.com. Thank you very much, and good luck. Change the world.